WDIY Lehigh Valley Public Radio presents Lehigh Valley Discourse. Provocative, informative, and newsworthy, Lehigh Valley Discourse brings you the people and the issues that move and shape our region here on WDIY. Good evening and welcome to Lehigh Valley Discourse. I'm James Johnson. Today's show is proud to welcome three Lehigh Valley residents who have become local leaders and the faces of civil rights reform in the fight against social injustice, police brutality, and systemic racism. Our nation is experiencing another moment of social reckoning in our long struggle with equality since it was declared with our independence that all men are created equal. This struggle is felt every day in neighborhoods of color affected by generations of systemic racism. Now more than ever, residents of the Lehigh Valley need to come together and listen to uncomfortable truths, sickening stories, and then seek ways to understand one another. Lehigh Valley Discourse welcomes Ashley Strange, regional organizer and co-founder of Lehigh Valley Stands Up, Justin Parker, founder of the Lehigh chapter of Black Lives Matter, and Reverend Dr. Gregory Edwards, pastor to the Resurrected Life Community Church of Christ here in Allentown. We begin with Ashley Strange. Welcome, Ashley.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
It's our pleasure. I do want to inform our listeners that Ashley Strange is a board member here at WDIY. Can you share with our listeners a little bit about your journey with activism?
Sure. I actually went to school in Alaska. I graduated from the University of Alaska Fairbanks. And up there, it's hard to kind of get into any kind of activism. There was more apathy up there. And a lot of that involving elections, especially national elections, was you would get in line to vote. It would be maybe like 5 o'clock, 4 o'clock. And we're 4 hours behind the East Coast. So you look up at a television and they're announcing the president of the United States and you haven't even had a chance to vote yet. So it's very hard to kind of like get involved and stay involved. But I was involved in student government on campus and a couple of efforts to get out the vote. But I do remember that whenever we would have a rally, it would always be covered by the news as low-key sign-waving. So I moved to Pennsylvania in 2013 to work for Amazon, worked for Amazon for a couple of years, drove school bus, you know, wrote for Bethlehem Press, a couple of other things. And then I found myself working 3 part-time jobs that didn't give me health insurance. And so for a while, I just kind of skated on past, just kind of looked 4 ways before crossing the street. And then somebody at the Pennsylvania Health Access Network reached out and they were like, hey, you know, you actually qualify for Medicaid. I'm like, oh, no, you don't understand. I'm like 20. They're like, no. It's not just for the elderly. It's for everyone, who needs it, who qualifies. Like there's all kinds of different qualifications. And then they kind of heard my story of working all these jobs and not having health insurance. And they're like, would you mind saying that at a town hall with Senator Toomey? Senator Toomey didn't show up, of course. But I got a chance to tell my story to quite a few people at the rally. And then they said, all right, well, Senator Casey's coming to town and he would also like to hear your story. And then, you know, they put me on a train and they were like, hey, can you go to Washington, D.C. and tell your story? So that's kind of how I got involved. And then I joined Make the Road Pennsylvania, which is a Latinx organization here in the Valley. And they were also fighting for healthcare. So I joined them. And after a little while, I was like, hey, I have a background in journalism and I want to do more than volunteer. And so I became the communications director there for a couple of years.
Tell us about your passion or the events that led up to your co-founding of the Pennsylvania chapter, Lehigh Valley Stands Up.
Right. So Pennsylvania Stands Up started as Lancaster Stands Up. So after the 2016 election, literally the day after, there was an emergency meeting called in Lancaster, and about 300 people showed up. And it was amazing. Basically, they got together in one big room and said, what happened? How can we keep it from happening again? And what are we going to do now? And so they all got together and decided to run people for Congress, for different seats. Like they did a whole bunch of training and they called themselves Lancaster Stands Up. So then York decided, oh, hey, like we could also stand up. And so kind of took the same model and duplicated it. you know, that was in 2016. So a few years later, they were like, this model is really working in Lancaster. Like, they were really the driving force in 2018 behind the Jess King for Congress campaign against Smucker and really, really pushing for positive change everywhere else. So, you know, they decided, let's do this statewide. This is really working. And so they started Pennsylvania Stands Up. And so Lehigh Valley Stands Up is one of 9 chapters in Pennsylvania Stands Up.
How does this moment feel different from past civil rights turning points and accomplishments, such as, let's say, Martin Luther King in the 60s, as well as Rodney King in the 90s?
It's been kind of a long, slow process. For a lot of people, they watch the news and kind of get like a tingly feeling, like on their arms, like the hair stands up when they hear certain things, when certain legislation comes down that wants to alienate trans people or stop people from crossing the border safely. They're putting children in cages. They're keeping trans kids from being able to get health insurance. It's really when you can see the government at all levels attacking the most vulnerable. That's when the hackles start to raise on the back of your neck and you start to kind of see that something much bigger is coming down the pike. In terms of this moment, this is something that has been really exciting for our members. A lot of people were stuck inside for the duration of the quarantine. And so there's a lot of things that you can do, like scrolling. And then with the murder of George Floyd, it was kind of a breaking point where people decided that they couldn't scroll anymore and let's get masks, let's get hand sanitizer. We need to demonstrate and we need to show that this isn't okay in, you know, Minnesota and it's not okay here. And so that first march back in May was really a push by a couple of queer youth who grew up in Bethlehem. And one of the things that I think made it, We had people raise their hands and like say which parts of the community they were from. And this was May 31st, so it was right before Pride Month. And there were so many LGBT folks out in that crowd. And it's really something when a whole community is telling you like, hey, a virus that the government is not taking care of in time and is killing thousands of my friends. I've seen this somewhere before. And a lot of them have seen it with the AIDS virus, that thousands of people died, the government did not act, and we're seeing it again. And so this is a moment where they really want to stand up and make sure that it doesn't happen again and share that history.
It's fair to say that people of color in the LGBTQ community clearly have things in common as far as discrimination.
Absolutely. Pride started because a black trans woman threw a brick at the Stonewall and started a riot. And a lot of times, especially when we're talking about the LGBT community, you know, the queer community, what folks are doing is they are really seeing all of those similarities. If you get pulled over by a cop and you're a white person, then you might have some buffer that might allow you to live through that traffic stop. But if you're in the LGBT community, it's more than likely that that's going to get more dangerous for you. And if you're a person of color, more dangerous still. And so that's how oppression kind of piles on top of oppression on top of oppression.
And clearly they relate to one another as groups in our society and our community locally.
Absolutely. I know that there are a couple of organizations, the Bradbury Sullivan Center, Project Silk in particular, has a POC queer youth organization. And they are basically pushing for queer youth of color to really take the forefront of all of this movement because they're the ones getting hit the hardest.
Well, how are they leading in the fight for social change?
A lot of them are their students in their schools and just by existing, honestly. A lot of the students in high schools at the GSA or the Gay Straight Alliances, they have this passion. They want to enact change, and they've wanted this for a while. And so, for example, there's students at the William Allen GSA, and they are pushing for better education, better sex education, better health education, because high schoolers get half a semester of health at William Allen. One of the other things they were really pushing for was changing how much money the school is actually getting to enact these things. And one student actually told me they were being bullied for being non-binary. And one of the things that their guidance counselor told them is, well, you know, you only have a few more hours left in today, so kind of forget about it, and then school will be out in only a couple of more months, so you'll get over it, you'll get past it. And it's not enough. It's not enough that these students are stuck somewhere where they feel unsafe all the time. And so when we talk about the LGBT community and the Black community really coming together and experiencing this, that's happening on a microcosm at all of the area high schools and middle schools. So having the students step up and actually start attending these school board meetings, and they have been meeting in the streets, they've been meeting on Zoom. They are getting together and they are discovering the power of what their voices can do.
What was your guttural first reaction to the edited 23-second viral video with Allentown Police Department and Edward Barrero?
This week actually marks 2 years since a South Whitehall Township police officer shot and killed a man called Joey Santos, who was unarmed, across from Dorney Park. People in this community have been fighting against police brutality for years. We have been saying the police need to be held more accountable. We have been saying stop hiring cops with records. We have been saying if you are just watching something terrible happen, then you also need to be censured. And then, after George Floyd's murder, we said, hey, remember all of that. And the Allentown Police Department and the mayor came forward and said, we will never let something like that happen here in Allentown. Even some of the representatives will say, if you say, well, what about what happened to Joseph Santos? They'll say, well, that wasn't in Allentown. That was South Whitehall. And so when I saw that video, the 23-second video, it was a Saturday afternoon, evening, and all of a sudden, all of my messaging apps just started exploding. And I was like, maybe it's someone's birthday, maybe something really good happened. No. All of a sudden, it was this video over and over and over again. And it was really hard to watch that happening. The coalition that I'm a part of here in the Lehigh Valley, that chat was, they said, like, what do we need to do? What do we need to find out? And one of the leaders in that chat is Justin Parker, who's part of Black Lives Matter Lehigh Valley. And he said, let's share this. Let's get the information out. Let's make sure that people see that it's happening again. This exact thing that Allentown Police Department had told us wasn't going to happen is happening again, and it's happening in our town. It was really, really difficult to watch. You can hear Mr. Barrero screaming, listen, listen, listen. He was screaming in Spanish, listen, listen, listen. And my mind, because I've been organizing for this long, my mind immediately went to, all right, what do we need to do? How do we need to get body cam footage? How do we need to find out he's okay? What press releases? What emails do we need to send out? What this? And people were like, let's take the streets. And I said, I don't know if we should take the streets. But what happened that night is over 100 people took the streets anyway, because that's not something you can plan. No organizer, no matter how good they are, can plan community anger and when it gets manifested.
Did the 9-minute 30-second video later released either provide context or deserve further condemnation?
The 9-minute video absolutely confirmed what we believed, that this was a man who was seeking help. Even if he wasn't seeking help, he was in need of help. And what he got instead was a knee to the neck. And using the 9-minute video, the DA and the Allentown Police Department decided to get into the nitty-gritty and say, oh, well, his knee wasn't actually on his neck. It was on his head. And it doesn't really matter where you are in terms of inches when you are pushing somebody's face into the concrete with your full body weight. So when our group saw the 9-minute video, at Lehigh Valley Stands Up, we have a team of people who for the last couple of months have been going through Allentown use of force policies, Bethlehem use of force policies, memorandums of understanding between the police department and school districts. And so they have just taken the time, about 100 people have just taken the time to just do a deep dive into what's happening on paper. And so we instantly had people that were taking a look at the footage and showing this is someone who needed help, and instead he got a knee to the neck.
You recently organized a Juneteenth event. Unfortunately, it was canceled due to weather, but you had it the following weekend. Have you received any feedback? And of the feedback, what do you feel it was its impact?
We mostly got feedback from the community around, but one of the biggest bits of feedback that we got was that this was an opportunity for Black folks to experience joy, as opposed to constantly, when we talk about Black History Month, it's usually about slavery or a handful of people a century ago that invented peanut butter and traffic lights. This is more of a celebration where we can say, this is where we're living now. And yes, it does center around slavery, but it centers around freedom from, because one of the biggest things is that we can't be free until we're all free. And that's why, you know, when people in the Black community are becoming enraged over what happened to Mr. Barrero, it's absolutely part of what we want to fight for, because we can't just fight for Black people. We can't just fight for the Latinx community. We can't just fight for the queer community. We are not free until we are all free.
You mentioned in your speech that day both reparations and voting. Why are both important in this national social moment of change?
When it comes to reparations that were paid after slaves were freed, the government actually promised a lot of slaves, former slaves, that they would have 40 acres and a mule. And that was meant to give you something to plant on, give a way to raise and earn money. But A, not everyone got that. B, the ones who did get it didn't even own that. And so they continued well into the last century to just being slaves still by sharecropping and other things. So when we talk about reparations, we're talking about the fact that there is an entire race of people that cannot attain wealth. Even people like, you think of very rich Black folks, Michael Jordan, Prince, these are people who didn't have wealth. They were still being paid. Michael Jordan still gets checks from the NBA, checks for sneakers, right? That's not wealth. He still has to work for that. So one of the things that we want to do is raise awareness to show that, you know, there's a reason why the Black and brown community is often accompanied by the poor community. People will sometimes conflate those into the same sentence.
Synonymous together.
Exactly. When we talk about reparations, there is a case for national reparations. There is a case for the government to make sure that we are being taken care of today, not just as an apology for everything that happened, but as an acknowledgement that the purchase of Black bodies created the economy that we live on today, and the descendants of those Black bodies are not reaping the benefits of that economy.
How does voting play into that as far as your activism, but also mobilizing the community at large to make this change?
When I talk to folks in the community about voting, especially youth that just turned 18 or might have just moved here, they have heard that if they register, if they vote, things will get fixed. If you register, if you vote for a certain person, all of your problems will be fixed. And A, that's not true, and B, they can see that that's not true. So if you get people out to vote and they get to the ballot box and they look at the ballot and they don't see themselves represented, they see names that they have only heard of in the last month or so leading up to the election because they've been pandered to, that's not how to vote. When we tell people to vote, we want to make sure that they are voting in their own self-interest and in the self-interest of their community. It is incredibly important that we have a strong, engaged electorate, and that if we have voted someone into office, then it doesn't matter whether or not you're registered to vote. We need your voice to keep them accountable to everything and make sure that the next time around, they get registered to vote again. And one of the biggest things is we want more people to run. In the last primary, almost every single race was unopposed. So one of the biggest things about voting is that in order to be a candidate, you need to be registered in a certain county for at least a year. By making people aware of what's going on by making people aware of who is making the decisions. That's how we get people out to vote. I was part of a meeting where people said, oh, well, we can register a bunch of people while they're waiting in line at soup kitchens. And that's a wonderful idea. But one of the problems with that is if you walk up to somebody who's in line at a soup kitchen and say, are you registered to vote? And they say, how is it going to help me? I'm literally in line for a soup kitchen. You need to be able to tell them there is candidate A, candidate B, and ballot measure A that is going to make sure that you are not going to lose WIC, that you are not going to lose SNAP, that your children are going to have health insurance, that your children are going to have a quality education, and that your entire family will be able to thrive. And if you can't go to the soup kitchen and tell them that, then don't go there and get people registered to vote.
Share with our listeners your vision of a future here in the Lehigh Valley.
When we started in January, we launched Lehigh Valley Stands Up in January. We are just little babies in some ways. We started with a bonfire. We held a bonfire in Center City. It was quite big. We got a lot of wood donated. The reason why we wanted to start with a bonfire is because we wanted to light this place on fire figuratively. We wanted to let people know that they can take their single match and put it on the fire, and collectively, we can all feel the warmth from it. But sometimes a lot of these systems are broken. Politics is broken. Politics is trauma. And in order to make it work for us, we need to make sure that some of these bastions that have been held for so long need to be let go and given back to the people. And so in order to make politics work for everyone, we all need to stand up. We need to expose corruption when we see it. Sometimes corruption is part of the law, and that's not right either. So we need to expose corruption when we see it. We need to collectively be brave and not only talk a big talk to senators on the phone or writing emails, but we need to be brave talking to each other, talking on Facebook, talking to people at Thanksgiving, if we have Thanksgiving in person, who knows. But we need to be brave, we need to stand up, and we need to push for not a progressive future, we need to push for a transformative future. So part of my vision for the Lehigh Valley is a changing of the guard, in a sense, making sure that the people that are making the decisions are not only listening to the people, but they are of the people. And I think that's my vision going forward.
I'd like to thank Ashley Strange, co-founder of the Lehigh Valley Stands Up chapter of the PA Stands Up organization, for joining us here on Lehigh Valley Discourse.
Thank you for having me.
We'll be right back. Welcome back to Lehigh Valley Discourse. Our next guest is Justin Parker. He is the founder of the Lehigh Valley chapter of Black Lives Matter. Welcome, Justin.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Would you mind sharing with our listeners a little bit about your journey with activism?
Yes, absolutely. So I want to say about 4 years ago when Philando Castile was murdered by a police officer, I went on Facebook and said that I was going to have a silent protest on 7th and Hamilton Streets in Allentown. I didn't think anybody was going to really show up, and when I got there on Saturday morning, I want to say maybe about four friends showed up, two family members, and I was out there for about 8 hours just with my fist raised in the air in solidarity with Philando. I got a lot of beeps with cars on my side. I got a lot of middle fingers. It was my first time actually being out there trying to do, I guess, what I thought at the time was my part in activism in Allentown. And then fast forward 4 years now with George Floyd, I again took a call to action and said that I was going to go on Facebook and I was going to do a protest and just do a peaceful protest. But this time, you know, it really grew legs. It, you know, the word got out, it got shared on social media, and we had a hundreds out there on 7th and Hamilton Street. And that's pretty much how this all started for me, really, with just creating, like, you know, Black Lives Matter Lehigh Valley, trying to get the awareness out there. And it's kind of grown even from there with regards to policy reform, conversations that I've been having with local politicians, chief of police, city council. That's pretty much how it got its start.
Well, tell us about the creation of the Lehigh Valley chapter of Black Lives Matter and how you became the founder and leader.
Really, with that, I went on the Black Lives Matter website trying to, you know, see if there were any chapters. The closest chapter we had to here was Philly. And so, you know, reached out to them, reached out to the Philly chapter and then the local national Black Lives Matter page, trying to get some feedback, insight, what, you know, we need to do to become a chapter, even do anything out there on our own, because what a lot of people don't know is we actually have to have a nonprofit organization as well. So it was kind of like all or nothing for me at that point. I was like, you know, we need to organize something. So I created the Black Lives Matter Allentown page on Facebook, just as a social media page, you know, something that was centralized for awareness to get the word out. That prompted me changing its name to Black Lives Matter Lehigh Valley, just that way we weren't just focused on Allentown, but the entire Lehigh Valley area. And then I ended up creating a Change Now, which was my official nonprofit to be registered, you know, with Black Lives Matter, then also to be able to focus on other social issues that we have as well out here in the area.
How does this moment feel different from past civil rights turning points and accomplishments? And your comment was, it's our time. I would hope that you'd be able to expand on that a little bit further.
Absolutely. With it, me saying like it's our time, our meaning more than just black and brown people. I think why there's really this big push and momentum is because we're not fighting this fight alone. We have a lot of white allies, co-conspirators, people of different colors, races, and generations that are really joining in this fight and saying, hey, you know, black lives do matter. There should be equality, and, you know, there should be police reform. So whereas before, Black Lives Matter was really just a movement or even just a group of black and brown people getting together to fight this cause, we're seeing arms stretched across the table to join in this fight and show in solidarity. So when I say it's our time, meaning our, the people, everyone, it's really our time to make this fight and to keep this momentum going.
And how does it differ from previous civil rights pivotal moments such as Martin Luther King's era and obviously the Rodney King 90s era?
I think how it differs, because I feel like the message or the messages have always almost been the same, but I feel that there's more activism and also, too, people wanting to vote and actually get representation and change where it matters. Like, for me, like, there's a lot of ignorance and not being educated on how we can make real change. I thought, or just, hey, saying something on social media and getting the status shared, and that way, you know, it'll be visible and it'll be seen. But the real change happens when you start influencing policy. You start holding your elected officials accountable for representing you. You start voting and getting people who voted into office that have your viewpoints or that are going to represent you. So I think that, you know, a lot of the change in momentum is that instead of asking for change or asking for equality, we're almost in a sense saying, hey, we're demanding it and we're going to put ourselves in positions of leadership and power and influence to change these policies and these laws that are affecting us and other people as well.
What was your guttural first reaction to the edited 23-second viral video with Allentown Police Department and Edward Barrero?
It was, wow, this is the story that we knew happened. And I say that because the statement that was released by the Allentown Police Department was, you know, there's more video coming, and it's really going to shed different light or piece the whole story together. And really, with that 23-second video, what it did was it kind of just reinforced or emphasize what we've been saying and what we saw from the social media video that was, like, I believe, like 8 seconds. But it was just like, wow, here in Allentown, are you serious? It doesn't have to be something that's nationwide. It can happen in your own backyard, and that's what we really wanted the people to see, that this is happening here, it happened anywhere.
Did the 9-minute, 30-second video later released either provide further context or deserve further condemnation?
Further condemnation, especially because even though there's not any audio on that video, anybody, the average person, can really piece together what they saw happening. We saw a man in distress. We saw, even at a point, he was on his knees, you know, almost in a praying position with his hands outstretched when the police officers came, because he almost kind of knew what was going to happen. And when you're thinking, like, you know, as a resident, you know, we have a lot of family members, a lot of people, you know, experience substance abuse or, you know, alcoholism or anything of those matters, people with, you know, a mental health issue as well. When you're thinking of being on a hospital sidewalk, you're there to get help and not handcuffs. And I think that from the video that we saw, it just kind of proved the point of the original video of, like, wow, are we really dealing with a knee to the neck or head situation so soon after George Floyd?
Your reaction to D.A. Martin's investigative conclusions and Chief Granitz's decisions?
It's hard to really call that an investigation. Our group and a lot of other, you know, groups asked for the investigation to be external. We didn't want the DA working the case. We wanted, you know, their office to refer to the Attorney General's office to remove any bias out of that. And, you know, unfortunately, that didn't take effect. We kind of knew that with Martin's office handling it, it would have came back that the officers were not in fault. And we kind of expected that from Chief Granitz as well, that, you know, there was going to be no disciplinary action. it wasn't enough for us to get the use of force policy to be public. We wanted there to be accountability measures and factors in there, and we didn't see that, which is why we're still continuing our use.
You have submitted to Allentown City Council the Eight That Can't Wait initiatives. Please explain for our listeners and how that process is moving forward currently.
Yes, so our group originally submitted that along with City Councilmember Josh Siegel, County Controller Mark Pensley, and really with the Eight Can't Wait initiative, it was, you know, eight can't wait mandates to be placed into the use of force policies, specifically here within the Allentown Police Department, to ensure that residents and citizens of the city, and even that don't reside here, would know what the use of force policy is and make sure that we ban chokeholds and hold officers accountable to intervene as well. In those meetings, and it was a 2.5-hour meeting with the chief of police and mayor, city council members, even the city solicitor, in those meetings, it was touted that, you know, we already have this in place. You know, these are things that we already are working on or we already do. And at that time, it was private. And it almost is kind of like, you know, a slap in the face that the use of force policy was made public, and then 9 days later this happened. So tomorrow there's a city council meeting with a resolution being brought, I believe it's Resolution 68, being brought up with regards to police reform and accountability. Councilwoman Cece Gerlach, Josh Siegel, and Cynthia Mota are sponsoring it, and it's really to put some accountability measures and factors into the Eight Can't Wait and the police reform that our group originally set out to mandate and get implemented into the Allentown Police Department.
Should there be efforts to defund area police or possible reallocation of their funding to community organizations and initiatives?
Absolutely. Some people are scared of the term defund the police, especially, you know, with the new ad going out, rising that the police are defunded. No one's going to be there to answer your 911 call. You'll get a response back in a week. Unfortunately, those are scare tactics. We usually like to follow up with the reallocation of funds. And it's very needed because with a large excessive police budget, funds can be allocated back into the community to add more social workers and mental health advocates to be first responders for, you know, social distress calls or mental health distress calls. It would put money back into local organizations and communities to ensure that our kids have a safe space and that our residents have a safe space as well. It would also go back into ensuring that our schools are funded. Right now, there's this phrase, school resource officer, which is, I think of a school resource officer and a lot of people that have these same thoughts. We think of additional guidance counselors or social workers, mental health advocates, even pastors that are there as resource officers for our children in schools, not police officers who are going to introduce black and brown youth into the criminal justice system from school. So I definitely feel that, you know, and believe that funds should be reallocated from the police department's excessive budget back into the community and to the residents.
How does the Lehigh Valley chapter of Black Lives Matter use technology to overcome hate and offer paths to peace?
In big ways. One thing that we always try to communicate is that even though this can be emotional and it can be emotional arguments at times, we try to use our social media platforms and technology to educate. So whether it's through Zoom meetings, through Facebook Lives, through our social media live feeds of the city council meetings, it's always important not to counter protesters. And what I mean by that is that usually they're out there to counter protest what our movement is or what we're trying to educate on. And to be honest, they're not really in positions of power for us to really try to educate. They're not coming out to listen to hear. They're coming out to listen to respond. So really, we want our message heard by city council members, by residents that are going to actually go out there and vote. And even for the opposers, you know, we welcome it open on a social media platform, a place to converse and a place to educate on the matter. But what we will not do in this sense is go back and forth and argue after we see that there's not a willingness to hear our point of view, as we have a willingness to hear other points of view.
What is your reaction to the events in Portland, Oregon, stemming from peaceful protests involving federal police forces?
It's a really scary situation because when you think of federal policing coming into play, we saw the mayor of, I believe it was Portland, being tear gassed out there trying to stand in solidarity with his protesters. Now, his stance has changed because, you know, his police force is part of the reason why this all escalated. But at times, that's what education and realization does. It makes you see the other point of view and to come out there and stand in solidarity. But what we're seeing is, you know, in Portland, they're trying to send in armed forces and troops to make it a police state. That's not how you're going to fix the situation. I always say there's no right or wrong way to protest. In Allentown, we haven't had any looting, or Lehigh Valley, we haven't had any looting or destruction of property. that there's no right or wrong way to tell people how to protest or to really tell them how to get their frustrations out. I think that Portland is a good example of what happens when the people are not being heard.
I understand you're a father, yes?
Yes, I'm a proud father of a 16-year-old daughter and a 13-year-old son. They also have autism.
As a father with special needs children, share with our listeners your vision of a future in the Lehigh Valley.
My vision for a future in the Lehigh Valley is one where the citizens and the people are able to effectively run their neighborhoods, their governments as well. It's where black and brown communities aren't policed on a daily basis. It's where I won't have to have a conversation with my brown son, who is African-American and Puerto Rican, about how to interact with police. My conversation with my son is not the same conversation that a white father would have with his son, unfortunately. And I want to be able to get to a place where our conversations are the same. But we have a lot of work to do with regards to that. But it's really a future with representation that really represents the people and the situations that are residing and living out here in the Lehigh Valley and in Allentown.
What else would you like to share with our listeners in the fight for social justice, equality, against police brutality, and systemic racism?
Yes, if I can share anything to touch on it, it would be, don't think that just because you're one person that you cannot effect change. I really was a nobody. Not even 4 years ago, but also before June, nobody really knew me in Allentown in a sense of, people that I grew up with or my family. Me just being one person, I was able to start a local Black Lives Matter organization. I was able to create a nonprofit, Change Now, out here in the Lehigh Valley, where I'm the executive director and have a team built around that to actually really have policies and programs to make change. I've been on policy change meetings. I was on a hearing today for police reform. I've been in closed-door meetings and have led protests and been a part of protests and outreach to make real change to dismantle systemic racism, oppression, lack of funding for our schools, and police reform. I'm just one person, but it started a movement with other people, and other people started moving with other people as well. So don't think just because you're one person that you can't make change. You can make change online, in person as well, and you can really foster those conversations with people that need to hear it. So we all have power, and power lies with the people, and it's just up to you what you're going to do with your time. What kind of ancestor are you going to be for your future generation?
It all starts somewhere and with one person. I'd like to thank Justin Parker, the founder of the Lehigh Valley chapter of Black Lives Matter. We appreciate you making time for Lehigh Valley Discourse here on WDIY.
Thank you again for having me.
We'll be right back. Welcome back to Lehigh Valley Discourse. WDIY is pleased to welcome Dr. Gregory Edwards, pastor to the Resurrected Life Community Church of Christ here in Allentown. Welcome, doctor.
It's good to be on WDIY. We support local radio, of course.
Thank you, sir. What I'd like to start off with, if I may, is can you share with our listeners a little bit about your journey with faith?
Well, I was raised in the AME Church. The AME Church stands for the African Methodist Episcopal Church. That church was born out of resistance when the founder of the church, Richard Allen, left St. George's Methodist Episcopal Church in the city of Philadelphia and went on later to be the founder of the AME Church. Later on, I was licensed and ordained in the Baptist Church and have had a very ecumenical formal education experience. I went to a Presbyterian undergraduate school, Geneva College, and then went to a Methodist divinity school, Drew Theological Seminary, and then did my doctorate degree in New Brunswick at the New Brunswick Theological Seminary, which is a Reformed seminary. And so in 2002, upon graduating from Drew University, Drew Theological School, I founded Resurrected Life Community Church. And I would just make one slight correction. We are now Resurrected Life Community Church, United Church of Christ. We have joined and become affiliated with the United Church of Christ. And, my faith is really grounded in this notion of righteousness and justice being inseparable theological acts that those that follow Christ must adhere to. So the work that I've done within the church and the community really has been steeped in what we would call the prophetic tradition, which really is decolonizing scripture, speaking truth to power, standing in the struggle with folks who've been left behind, left out, picked on, passed by. And that's really why the church then, though we started in 2002, we created the Resurrected Community Development Corporation in 2011, because we believe that our faith and our spiritual journey calls us to ensure that we are educated, specifically that we are educating those that have not been educated or miseducated within various educational structures and institutions, public school notwithstanding. So we created the Resurrected Community Development Corporation, which is a separate 501c3, a separate board of directors, which I'm the president of, and that entity is the fiduciary agent for the Resurrected Life Children's Academy, which is a Star 4 state-licensed early learning center that has an enrollment of about 120 children. We have 25 full-time staff, and we provide full-time, Monday through Friday, best practice early learning for children K through 5. We prepare our children for learning and for life. And then in addition to the Resurrected Life Children's Academy, we also, our organization, RCDC, as we abbreviate it, really originated the Freedom School movement within the Lehigh Valley. So we partnered with the Children's Defense Fund. Many of our listeners might know that the Children's Defense Fund is a child in poverty, anti-poverty program that was really founded and instituted by Marion Wright Edelman, who was the first black woman to graduate from Mississippi with her law degree. She was a freedom rider in 1964, descended into Mississippi along with other college-age students, and not only registered black folk to vote, because Mississippi really was the last state that granted voting rights to black folk, but with the young people, many of those college young folk gathered up children and young people under poplar trees, in fellowship halls of churches and community centers, outside in fields, and really taught them in a way that they were not being taught within their educational institutions because of racism and all of those insidious things that happen to many of our children in those environments. So these freedom schools now, 25 years later, there's about 150 around the nation, are 6 to 8 week intense summer learning, literacy, and leadership academies for African American and Latinx children who are in grades K through 12, where we teach them how to fall in love with themselves and how they can make a difference in their family, community, nation, and world. And then we do a great deal of civic engagement, teaching and educating people around their voting rights, around issues that are impacting their daily life that might be not so visible.
How has your work in the past with human and civil rights brought you to this moment we are witnessing right now?
Well, you know, I mean, this is a moment that I hope that we are, in the words of my friend, the Reverend Dr. William Barber, I hope and believe and I trust that we are on the precipice of perhaps America's third reconstruction. And I believe that there are some of us who actually are alive in this moment. I don't want to romanticize the horrific nature of this moment that is deeply steeped in injustice. But there are many of us who have not been alive, were not alive, in the era of Dr. King, Jim Crow, lynching, segregation, of course, housing discrimination, and all of its ills in relationship to white supremacy still continue to this day. But there are many of us who were not alive during that period, who believe that we were trained and educated formally and informally, specifically for such a time as this. And so it's, you know, it's my great privilege to be able to be alive at this moment, to be able to be mentoring some of the young people who are out there in the streets, talking and mentoring them around nonviolent direct action, talking about how we move from protest to public policy. And I mean, I'm fortunate that I stand on the shoulders of a great deal of people who poured into me personally. Reverend James Lawson, the Reverend Dr. Bill Howard, who was the first African-American to lead the National Council of Churches and also the New York Theological Seminary. We are blessed and fortunate to have him alive in this moment. He's still with us. I talk to him every day. And other folks, Otis Moss Jr., Marion Wright Edelman, Reverend Dr. William Barber. These are our co-conspirators in the moment that we are in. And I'm fortunate, as I said, to not only be standing in the shadows of ancestors and even mentors who have poured into me formally, but also one of the formative experiences of my life is that Morehouse College, which is located in Atlanta, Georgia. Morehouse College, which is a historically black college and university, which also was the alma mater for folks like Julian Bond, Andrew Young, Dr. King, an institution that was served by Benjamin Elijah Mays, and also Howard Thurman, that I was invited by Morehouse College to be one of a select handful of clergy around the nation who were embodying the philosophical theology of Dr. King, but also his fight for human and civil rights. And that was a formative time of postgraduate experience that I really cherish and hold in my heart, because it really helped to connect me in a very heartfelt and meaningful way to the work of one of my heroes, Dr. King.
With the national moment on the precipice, as you put it, the Lehigh Valley recently drew its focus. What was your guttural first reaction to the edited 23-second viral video with Allentown Police Department and Edward Barrero?
Well, the fact of the matter is that video, as horrific as it is one of thousands and thousands of videos, or one of thousands and thousands of scenarios that have happened in our nation's history, yet we have now something available to us that our forerunners didn't, and that is technology and cellular devices that can capture for the world and capture for the nation the atrocities that are being committed specifically against people of Black African heritage and Latinx heritage. So my first response was, unfortunately, many of us have become anesthetized to those videos. I'm just glad someone was there to capture it so that other folks who have been inoculated or silent could see the horror that many of us live with day in, day out. And of course it's in Allentown. Allentown is not immune from racism. Allentown is not immune from white supremacy. Allentown is not immune from police brutality. I would say much of it locally in the Lehigh Valley has been suppressed. And there's been this notion, even in the aftermath of that video, that up until now, most of the protests have been peaceful. And I always go back to Dr. King's definition of peace. Peace is not merely the absence of tension, but peace really is about the presence of justice. You can't have peace without justice. And so simply because someone didn't, quote unquote, act violent or there was no rioting and no looting, doesn't mean that we have a peaceful, sleepy little valley. We know that there are many people, specifically Black and brown folk, who every day are confronted by racism in Allentown, in Bethlehem, and in Easton. It's just not captured in any type of video or footage. But this has been going on for years. Of course, you know, I work and worship in a city, and some of my family live in Allentown. We are reminded that the city of Allentown is named after William Allen. And we know, if we read our history, that William Allen was actively involved in the slave trade. And so when we look at William Allen, and we look at his business partner, Joseph Turner, and it's ironic that our church is located at the corner of 9th and Turner Street. Well, Turner Street is named after Joseph Turner, the business partner of William Allen, and Joseph Turner was also one of the largest slave traders, not just in the Lehigh Valley, but really on the eastern seaboard of the United States. And then we look at Benjamin Chu. Benjamin Chu married William Allen's daughter, so it was a father-son-in-law relationship. He was involved in the slave trade, as well as Joseph Tillman. So I do my work in a city that every day is named after people who actively engaged in the slave trade. So I reminded that many folk in Allentown, a few folk in Allentown, actually had slaves that lived as domestics in their homes and performed work for them, or were rented out to other folk that could not afford slaves. So that's the environment that we live in, and the Lehigh Valley is, for many of us, an unlevel playing field, because racism at a systemic level and structural level has really never been addressed.
I was impressed with your knowledge of local history at the Juneteenth protest and the significance of the street your church is located on. Again,
right.
My question was going to be, please share with our listeners that and more uncomfortable local history, and I think you kind of nailed it there.
Right. I mean, I think I said that Brother Joe Turner, there I called him brother, only as another human being that lived and walked on the face of the earth at one time. I'm sure he's turning over in his grave somewhere knowing that there is predominantly a church of African-American or Black African heritage, although we are multiracial and multicultural, that does so much work around folks who are marginalized and so much work around ensuring that our struggle and our fate are tied together with individuals who have been considered the least of these, specifically those that have been the victims of racial toxicity and white supremacy. So these landmarks that we walk by, many folks don't know the history of this area. We take for granted. So we have a high school named after William Allen. We have a city named after Will now. We drive these streets every day. And I'm a firm believer in that often quoted cliche, if you don't know where you've come from or you don't know your history, you are only bound to repeat it. The past is prologue to the present. And so, you know, I think that there's a reason why there's so much repression of soul in the city as it relates to there being a general fear that if we name white supremacy and racism, that that's going to turn people off or it's going to deconstruct their deeply mythologized notion of the Queen City, a city that has a mantra of being a city without limits. And we know that that's just words until it's put in practice structurally. So I would advise folks to, when you move anywhere, read the history of that place. Do a little excavating. And as I've said with some of my colleagues, you know, white supremacy is the pre-COVID pandemic, and racism is the pre-COVID pandemic. You know, there's no place that is immune from it. There's no institution that is immune from it. There's no person that's been impacted by it. I say that white supremacy will kill all of us, whether you are white, black, or brown. It just will kill some of us sooner than others. If, in fact, we believe what Dr. King said to be true, that we are all held together in an inescapable web of mutuality, what impacts one impacts all of us. And I do believe that. I do believe that. So there's no place that we can hide. And I think part of the difficulty of addressing white supremacy or racism is that as soon as we address it, if we don't address it from a system perspective, if we just call someone a racist or a white supremacist, that ends the conversation. All of us have been impacted and robbed and dehumanized. It's stolen something from the soul of white people as well. And unless we are able to name that and then work collectively to dismantle that and advance through creating structures and policies and systems that are just, that are equitable, that are fair, then I think we all lose. Look, the Allentown School District is the largest, arguably the largest public institution in the Lehigh Valley. It serves 18,000 students. Its budget is twice the size of the city of Allentown. It now currently has a population that's 90% plus children of color. But because the state of Pennsylvania, the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, doesn't have a fully funded, fair educational formula, our inner city landlocked, low tax based school districts are under resourced. So even though we fought for Brown v. Board of Education, Topeka, Kansas in 1954, most of our schools are deeply racially segregated. We know as it goes with the children in Allentown, as it goes with the school district in Allentown, it goes with the city. So we can try to gentrify it and build buildings and glass, and we've got to attract business, and I understand all that from an economic development perspective. But unless one really cares deeply about these children, our children, doesn't make a difference because there's no place you're going to be able to run from it. It's going to impact housing stock. It's going to impact who moves in and who moves out. Our fate is tied together, and I really believe that.
Did the 9-minute, 30-second video later released either provide context or deserve further condemnation?
Well, that 9-plus-minute video was not video of the body cam. That 9-plus-minute video was video released, I believe, by the police department, but on behalf of and from the video cameras of St. Luke's Sacred Heart Hospital. So context for brutality means very little. I mean, there are other ways to de-escalate. And if you think about it, that in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, there's a higher hourly requirement for people to get their barber license to be a barber than there are to be a trained and released officer of the law. So think about that for a moment. Think about the fact that there is a more stringent hourly requirement for people that cut hair, for hairdressers, than there are for people that we empower with a badge and a bullet and a gun.
I'm aware of that, and I find that frightening just as much.
Yeah.
Let me jump into your reaction to D.A. Martin's conclusions from the independent investigation and Chief Granite's decisions from that.
Well, I mean, I'm not surprised. My reaction is that it's business as usual. And for those individuals that say, you know, this is not my Lehigh Valley, this is not the place where I was raised, it's not the city I know, you know, I would remind those listening to this clip that just a few years ago, less than 4 years ago, Joey Santos, a brother from Paterson, New Jersey, who was in mental health distress outside of Dorney Park, South Whitehall Township, same county, same DA, lost his life when a very green, immature, not thoroughly trained South Whitehall Township police officer chose his first recourse to take off Joey Santos's head, literally. And that officer, though he was charged, walked, and most likely is somewhere else in another police department. So this is not the first case of police brutality that has been in existence in Allentown. We have in the city of Allentown's paid out $1.7 million to families on behalf of the city and its insurance carriers because of police brutality, whether it is wrongful arrest or literally an officer breaking someone's jaw, also caught on video. So, you know, what happened at St. Luke's Hospital is nothing new. Unfortunately, I have become an expert. I say this as a pastor, as a theologian, as a scholar, as a sociologist, I've become an expert in my people's pain. It's unfortunate, you know, part of how we educate and insulate ourselves is by making sure our facts, our data, our intel, our research is accurate, because some people can't see through their feelings the facts are incorrect. And these things that I am telling you, whether it be the history of Allentown or the situations that are happening in the police department and the amounts of money that have been paid out or what's happening in the school district, these are non-negotiable. These are absolute facts. And as they say, facts don't lie. Facts can be misinterpreted. They can be misconstrued. They can be misrepresented. But the bare bone minimum facts don't lie. They don't lie. And for Jim Martin, under the previous case, to say that there is no racism within the police departments that he inevitably assist with is, I mean, anybody, Republican or Democrat, black or white, anybody with any level of intelligence knows that racism exists within any institution, and the institutions that he might be very fond of are not immune. So, yeah, I mean, I believe that his conclusion were absolutely incorrect, but not surprising, not surprising. So I think also, too, it's ultimately in terms of the outcome of that and other future perhaps cases that will happen, it's ultimately going to be about the power of the people. That the power of the people, when organized, can overtake people who are in positions of power. That's really what Dr. King was all about when we talk about protest and rallying and nonviolent direct action. Nobody minds a protest. Nobody minds a rally, specifically if there's a level of disorganization and not cohesion or discipline. What folks do mind is that if there's a protest and rally, if at the end of that there is a demand or an exchange of power, that's when people start getting upset.
Share with our listeners your vision of a future Allentown.
Well, I see a city that will become increasingly more diverse. Allentown now has 71% of her residents that are people of color. I see an Allentown whose political and economic and educational leadership reflect the racial and cultural demographics of her residents. I see an Allentown that does not rely on a toxic charity model to masquerade as justice. I see an Allentown that is built upon the foundation of justice and vibrancy of diversity. And that's my hope, and that's my belief, and that's why I'm still in the struggle and still at the corner of 9th and Turner.
I'd like to thank Reverend Dr. Gregory Edwards, pastor to the Resurrected Life Community Church of Christ here in Allentown, for joining us on Lehigh Valley Discourse.
Thank you so much for your time.
I am grateful for Ashley, Justin, and Dr. Edwards' valuable time. My hope is that if we all, as Lehigh Valley residents, take a moment to listen, we can all seek first to understand. Thank you for joining me here on Lehigh Valley Discourse.